All right, so today we're going to really dig into Lamentations.
Okay.
Specifically, we're looking at chapter 5, verses 1 through 7.
All right.
And we're going to be using a lecture by Dr. Leslie Allen to kind of guide us through both. And this chapter is really where the book takes a turn.
Interesting.
It's like, you know, if you're thinking of it as a story,
Yeah.
you've kind of reached this point of really intense grief, and then like a glimmer of hope starts to emerge.
Oh, okay.
And so the people of Jerusalem are really just overwhelmed with grief. But we start to see them actually turn to prayer in this really unique way.
So what's so different about this prayer? What makes it stand out?
Yeah, so well, Dr. Allen points out that this chapter is, like I mentioned, it's unique, and he calls it a prayer lament.
A prayer lament.
Yeah, so you can almost think of it like they're taking the emotion of a funeral lament,
Right.
but they're bringing it directly to God.
Oh, so they're not just asking for help. They're really expressing their raw grief and sorrow.
Exactly. Yeah, it's not just like, hey, God, you know, can you give us a hand here?
Yeah.
It's infused with this deep, deep grief.
That's got to make it all the more powerful. I mean, you can really feel the weight of their emotions.
Absolutely. And, you know, Dr. Allen even suggested that in ancient Israel, you know, prayer could actually be a form of persuasion.
Oh, interesting.
So you would present your case to God almost as if you're a lawyer in a courtroom.
Oh, wow. So, like, you're trying to convince a judge.
Yeah,
That's
exactly.
a whole different way of thinking about prayer.
Yeah. And so if we're kind of like imagining this as this courtroom drama, what do you think is their strongest argument? Like, what's the one thing that they're really hitting on that they believe God had to intervene?
Well, I mean, we have to remember the historical context here, right?
Right.
Jerusalem has fallen. The temple, which is the center of their faith, is destroyed.
It's unimaginable.
And the people are now living under enemy occupation.
They've lost everything.
Yeah, their whole world has been completely upended. And, you know, Dr. Allen actually makes a really interesting point. He says, it's not just the physical destruction that they're dealing with.
It's the emotional and spiritual fallout.
Exactly, yeah.
Like, how do you even begin to process that?
It's hard to even fathom, right? So they've lost their land,
Right.
homes, obviously,
Of course.
their social standing, even basic necessities, things like water and wood.
Which you would just take for granted.
Totally. And now they're having to pay a price for those things.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and this kind of leads us to the framework that Dr. Allen uses to analyze the chapter.
Okay.
He looks at it through these three lenses: grief, grievance, and guilt.
Okay, so grief, I think we can all wrap our heads around that. I
Yeah.
mean, losing everything you know and love, that's got to be devastating.
For sure.
But how does grievance play into this?
Well, the grievance is tied directly to the enemy occupation.
Okay.
So they're suffering because of what's been done to them by this outside force.
So they're pointing a finger, basically.
Yeah, in a sense, they've been robbed of their freedom, their security, their dignity, all of it taken away.
And the guilt part. Now that's where things get a little trickier, right?
It does. So in verses 6 and 7, they start to blame their ancestors for making bad deals with foreign
They're
powers.
saying, like, this is all your fault.
Yeah, kind of like they're saying that those past decisions led to their current state. But here's the interesting part. They don't stop there.
Oh, so they acknowledge their own role in the whole mess.
That's exactly it.
Wow.
They admit that they haven't always followed God's ways either. And Dr. Allen points out this is a much more nuanced view of responsibility than what we see in some other parts of the Bible.
Oh, really? Like where?
Well, like in Ezekiel 18, for instance, you see people trying to shift all the blame onto past generations.
It's like that old saying, passing the buck.
Yeah, exactly. But here in Lamentations, they're owning up to it. They're recognizing a shared responsibility.
So it's not just woe is me. It's more like, okay, we messed up too.
Precisely. They're laying out their suffering, acknowledging their part in it, and appealing to God's sense of justice.
It's like they're building a case, like you said.
Yeah, exactly.
But they're also doing it with this intense grief.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it's important to remember that the loss of their land, it's not just about the physical territory.
Right. It's about more than just losing property.
Dr. Allen really emphasizes this. He says, for the Israelites, losing their land has deep theological significance.
So there's a spiritual component to it.
Definitely. For them, the land was a gift from God.
A symbol of his favor.
Right, a sign of their covenant with him.
So losing the land means that relationship is broken.
It's like a physical manifestation of that brokenness. And to understand just how seriously they took this whole idea of land ownership, Dr. Allen actually brings up a story from 1 Kings 21.
Okay, what happens? I'm intrigued.
So it's the story of King Ahab,
Okay.
and he has this insatiable desire for his neighbor's vineyard.
He wants those grapes, huh?
He wants that land. and his greed leads him to have his neighbor falsely accused and killed just so he can seize the vineyard.
That's pretty extreme measures to get your hands on some grapes.
Right. But the point is, the prophet Elijah shows up and delivers God's judgment on Ahab. And it's this really harsh judgment. It highlights just how seriously God considers the violation of land rights.
So it's not just a human law kind of thing. It's like a divine principle.
Exactly. The land is sacred. It's part of their covenant with God. So for the people in Lamentations, being robbed of their land by enemies, this isn't just a political defeat. It's a spiritual crisis.
Right. It's like their whole world, both physically and spiritually, has been turned upside down.
Absolutely. They've been cut off from their divine inheritance. And that just fuels their lament even further. It really underscores that deep sense of injustice and loss.
So they're grieving the loss of everything they hold dear.
Yeah.
Their relationship with God feels broken.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, in the middle of all of this, this despair, they still turn to prayer.
And that's what's incredible, isn't it? Even after all of this, they still see prayer as a way to connect with God.
It's like a lifeline.
Yeah, and there's this subtle shift happening in this chapter. You can start to sense it.
Oh, I'm ready for some hope here. What are you seeing?
Well, look at the very first verse. They say, "Remember, O Lord, what has befallen us."
Okay.
It's simple but powerful. They're directly addressing God. They're laying their pain bare before him.
They're not hiding their feelings.
Not at all. They're still hurting. They're still questioning. But there's a glimmer of hope in that act of turning back to God.
So even in their darkest hour, they're choosing to believe that prayer might be the key to a new beginning.
Exactly. It's a fragile hope, but it's there. And that's what makes this chapter so powerful. It's not just a lament. It's the beginning of a journey back to God.
A journey of faith.
Repentance.
And ultimately of hope.
Yes, but we'll delve deeper into that journey in the next part of our deep dive.
We left off with that image of the people turning back to God, but like their journey isn't over.
No, not at all.
You know they're still in the thick of it.
Yeah, they're still deep in that valley of despair.
Really grappling with this immense suffering.
And you really see it come to life in verses 8 through 16.
Oh, okay.
It's like this gut punch.
Really?
This stark portrayal of their daily reality under enemy occupation.
You know, you mentioned earlier that this prayer lament is different.
Right.
So what makes this section so unique?
Well, remember how Dr. Allen pointed out that this whole chapter borrows from the style of a funeral lament.
Mm-hmm.
And that's typically a secular expression of grief.
Right.
But here, it's like it's interwoven with prayer.
So they're bringing that raw emotion.
Exactly.
Into their dialogue with God.
Yeah, it's this raw, unsettling dialogue with God.
So they're not holding back.
No.
It's just raw pain, anger, fear, all of it.
Yeah, they're pouring it all out directly to God. And that's what makes it so powerful, right?
Yeah.
It's brutally honest. I mean, take verse 8, for instance. They say, "Slaves rule over us. There is no one to deliver us from their hand."
You can just feel the weight of it, like that helplessness.
That utter helplessness, yeah. And it gets worse. I mean, in verse 9, they talk about risking their lives just to get food.
Wow.
Because of the danger in the wilderness.
So, like, every time you need to eat, you're risking your life.
You're putting your life on the line.
That must have been so demoralizing.
Incredibly demoralizing.
To live with that kind of fear.
And their physical suffering is compounded by this profound sense of shame and humiliation.
Oh, okay.
So in verse 11, they describe these horrific acts of violence against women.
That's awful.
Yeah, it's this complete violation of their dignity and security.
It's like their suffering goes beyond just like the physical hardship.
Right.
It really cuts to the core of who they are.
It cuts to the very core of their being. And it's not just individual suffering either. You know, their whole social order has been completely shattered. Verse 12 talks about princes being hanged, elders being disrespected.
So everything that gave them structure.
Yeah, identity, a sense of belonging, it's all gone.
It's been stripped away.
And that loss, you really feel it throughout this section. In verse 13, they describe forced labor, young men being crushed under these impossible burdens.
It's just this bleak picture of exploitation and despair.
Is there anything in this section that stands out to you?
You know what really gets me is verse 14.
Okay.
Elders have ceased to sit at the gate and young men from their music.
Right.
I don't know why, but that one line, it just...
It speaks to a loss that goes beyond the physical.
Yeah.
It's the loss of community.
Right.
A silencing of joy and tradition.
It's like the very fabric of their society has just completely unraveled.
Yeah.
They've lost their land, their homes, their security, their dignity.
And even the simple things that brought them joy.
Connection.
And it's right here in this moment, in the depths of their despair.
Yeah.
They cry out to God.
Oh, wow.
Verse 15, "The joy of our hearts has ceased. Our dancing has been turned to mourning."
So they're acknowledging the emptiness.
Yes, the depth of their loss.
But even in that expression of grief, isn't there a glimmer of hope there?
I think so.
The fact that they're still turning to God.
Right, they're still expressing their pain to him.
Even when they feel abandoned by him.
Yeah, it's like even when they feel abandoned by God, they still recognize that he's the only one who can truly restore them.
They're clinging to that faith.
That sliver of faith, that desperate hope that he might hear their cry.
And offer them a way out of this darkness.
Yeah.
You know, it's a powerful reminder that even in our darkest moments, when we feel completely lost,
broken.
There's still a place for prayer.
Absolutely.
For that raw, honest dialogue with God. You know, it's incredible to me that even after everything they've been through, they still have the strength to turn to God.
Right.
Like, what would it take to completely break their spirit?
Well, in these final verses of chapter 5, verses 16 through 22,
okay,
the prayer takes on a whole new dimension.
Oh, really?
It's not just about pouring out their pain anymore.
It's changing.
It shifts into this plea for restoration.
Okay.
Almost like a desperate bargain with God.
So what's their approach here? Like, how are they trying to convince God to step in?
Well, it starts with a pretty profound act of humility.
Mm-hmm.
Verse 16, they say, the crown has fallen from our head. Woe to us, for we have sinned.
They're acknowledging their own failings.
Yeah, like they're saying, look, we know we haven't always been perfect. Maybe this is our punishment.
So no more blame game.
Right. They're owning up to their part.
They're taking responsibility.
And that's crucial. Because by admitting their own shortcomings,
yeah,
they're creating space for God's mercy.
It's like they're saying, we're not trying to justify anything we did. We just need you.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you can't really ask for help if you're not willing to admit you need it in the first place. Right.
Makes sense. So they've admitted their guilt, but how do they then go from that to actually pleading for restoration?
They basically lay bare their vulnerability.
Okay.
In verse 17, they say, because of this, our heart is sick. Because of these things, our eyes have grown dim.
It's like they're saying, look at us. We're broken. We need you to heal us.
Yeah, it's raw. And remember how Dr. Allen talked about their deep fear of disgrace?
Right.
That comes up again here.
Really?
Yeah, verse 18, they lament the desolation of Mount Zion.
Right, which was this powerful symbol for them.
Of their faith and their identity. So losing Zion, that's not just a military defeat.
Right, it's so much bigger than that.
It's a blow to their very soul.
Everything has just been completely upended.
But then there's this remarkable turn.
Okay.
Their prayer shifts from lament to this incredible affirmation.
What do you mean?
Verse 19, but you, O Lord, reign forever. Your throne endures to all generations.
Oh, wow.
Like they're reminding themselves, and maybe even God, that even though their world has crumbled, his power remains.
Yeah.
It's unwavering.
It's a powerful reminder that even when everything around us feels temporary, there's still something eternal out there.
Absolutely. And this realization, it seems to give them the courage to kind of move from despair to direct petition.
Oh, okay.
So verse 20, they ask this really bold question.
Like what?
They ask, why have you forgotten us forever? Why have you forsaken us for so long?
Wow, it's almost like they're challenging God.
Right, it shows just how desperate they are for his attention.
Like they're demanding to be heard.
And it also reveals their belief that God can intervene. You know,
that he has the power.
He has the power to change their situation. And then that leads to the climax of their prayer, verse 21. Restore us to yourself, O Lord, that we may be restored. Renew our days as of old.
It's not just about rebuilding the city or anything.
Right.
It's a yearning for that relationship they once had with God.
It is. They're recognizing that true healing, true restoration can only come from God. But even as they make this heartfelt plea, there's this flicker of doubt.
What do you mean?
Well, look at that very last verse, verse 22. Unless you have utterly rejected us and are angry with us beyond measure.
Even as they're asking for restoration, yeah, you're worried he might have given up on them.
It's that vulnerability, again, that honesty,
yeah,
that makes it so relatable, even thousands of years later.
Absolutely. It reminds us that faith isn't about blind certainty.
It's about choosing to believe, even when doubt creeps in, even when you feel completely alone.
This deep dive has been quite a journey. We've explored this intense grief, witnessed the raw power of lament, and glimpsed those first fragile signs of hope.
And what's amazing is how this ancient prayer, it still resonates with us today. You know, it teaches us that even when we're facing unimaginable loss, when our world feels like it's falling apart, we can still turn to God, pour out our hearts, and dare to hope for a new beginning.
Thank you for joining us on this journey through Lamentations 5. And until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep diving deep.